He has been guilty of that sin ever since. It is now inherent in his makeup. This selfish instinct must be eliminated before he can again find the Father's kingdom. No fences or other evidences of individual ownership surround the millions of homes on Mars. No lines of demarcation divide one plot of land from another. The millions of beautiful homes, beautiful in their simplicity, for over-ornamentation such as the dwellers of your Earth practice, is not tolerated on our planet, belong to the Commonwealth. The same are allotted to the individual as a life tenure only. The same custom prevails in the matter of personal property. Should a Martian have use for a flying machine, also used by another, or other kind of property for personal use, he does not ask the use of same in the spirit that your Earth dwellers borrow from one another. Use of the needed article is requested with the idea that it belongs to the community, that all material possessions are the common property of the entire race. The millions of Martians live as one family. It is this solidarity, this filial consideration that one holds for the other that has made the stupendous and gigantic public works on Mars possible. In the absence of a universal unity of purpose, intelligent life on Mars would have become extinct centuries ago, when the last remnants of its oceans and seas dried up and a planetary irrigation system became necessary in order to utilize the frozen polar moisture. Chapter 6. Distribution of commodities. Barter and trade are unknown on Mars. The entire race of Martians is cooperative, and the production of all necessities is based on the needs of the Commonwealth. Specialization in different branches of industrial activity is centralized, as is the case of your Earth. That is, some particular parts of the planet, owing to climatic and other conditions, are better adapted for the production of some special kind of raw material used in the manufacture of clothes or other necessities of life, or the production of some particular foodstuff. But in every case, the incentive for industrial activity is not material profit. On the contrary, the real incentive is compliance with the Father's will. Transportation is effected by means of flying ships actuated by the control of gravitational attraction. These vehicles of the air, beside your crude affairs, are most perfect, and the amount of freight carried is unlimited, for the reason that the gravitational attraction of the cargo is nullified as well as that of the ship. A more extended explanation concerning this matter is given in another section of this book. Another motive power used is cosmic, or universal energy. We shall refer to this later. Immense warehouses and depots are scattered throughout the entire planet. These are centers of distribution. These warehouses are filled with what all the people of the entire planet need in the way of food, clothing, and other necessities of life. These depots are in charge of trained and competent workers who attend to the issuance and distribution of all commodities. When a Martian is in need of any particular commodity, he makes application to have his wants supplied to the depot nearest to his habitation. He immediately receives the needed article. If the quantity and nature of his requisition is too large for him to carry personally, the same is delivered at his domicile by the Commonwealth's Transportation Department. Chapter 7. Clairvoyant visions of Mars. In connection with the revelation contained in this book concerning the physical characteristics of Mars, the compiler of this volume, as well also as the medium, was given much information concerning this advanced planet by means of clairvoyant visions. These pictures were given the writer at different times, commencing early in 1920, and continuing until the book was finished. As has been explained by the controls who have been instrumental in giving the information about Mars, the purpose of these clairvoyant pictures was to give the compiler of this book real visual evidence as to life on Mars, and in particular, real pictures setting forth its topography, which could be elucidated in no other way. Written descriptions of scenery and of human activities necessarily fall short of the reality, especially when an attempt is made to record a series of events or a point of view outside the realm of our experience. The first picture realized by the writer, and for that matter the most important one, was the view given him of Rhd the Beautiful, one of the most important centers of population on the planet Mars. It was while lying in bed one morning the writer was contemplating the many messages being received from the Martian, who is the dictator of the subject matter of this book, that he found himself at a strange place, suspended as it were in the air over a beautiful lake of blue water, whose surface was broken by gentle ripples, due to the soft, balmy breeze blowing over the surface of the water. The writer was facing what seemed to be a westerly direction, and at a distance of about 5 miles there arose a series of small mountains about 2,500 feet in altitude. These mountains skirted the shores of the lake. The sky was a beautiful blue, bluer than the sapphire-tinted skies of our own desert lands. The mountains were tinted red from base to top, except where the moisture near the shores of the lake had stimulated a vegetal growth, whose green contrasted most harmoniously with the red of the soil. Two white clouds floated majestically near the peaks of the highest mountains. The atmosphere was impressively clear and all objects seemed to stand out in sharp definition, a condition seldom seen by dwellers on our Earth except in extremely dry and arid regions. On top of a small plateau, forming the crown of a low-lying hill at the base of one of the highest mountains, and about 1,500 feet from the shoreline, I was startled to see a large city. The thousands of closely nestling buildings seemed to be built of white stone. The writer was lost in admiration, for there in front of him the pure white of the city, contrasting so vividly with the red soil of this far-away planet, stood the habitations of an advanced race many millions of miles removed from my own world. The writer was impressed with the fact that, with but few exceptions, the buildings of gleaming white were all one story in height, and it became instantly evident that crowding is not tolerated by the inhabitants of this progressive planet. A few structures towered above the rest. These, as the writer was informed later, were the public buildings dedicated to the use of the people as lecture halls, centers for music and art, etc. On a subsequent occasion the writer was shown a close-up view of Rid. Flowers, grass and green foliage abounded everywhere. The long streets were broad and well paved, and flanked on two sides with long rows of one-storied buildings of white stone, beautiful in their simplicity. No extreme ornamentation is carried out in the erection of buildings on Mars. On the contrary, the simple square outlines characteristic of our own old mission architecture seems to prevail on the planet Mars. The same simple style prevails with the public buildings, except that massive stone columns marked the portals of same, reminding one of our own early Grecian architecture. Many palm-like trees grew all over the city, especially in the neighborhood of the public buildings. A week after the occurrence of the above incident, the writer was shown, in the same manner as before, one of the many canals that gridiron the Martian globe. This particular canal is one of the main waterways on Mars, and appeared to be about a mile wide at the point of observation. The water was of a deep blue color, denoting great depth. Along the banks of this waterway could be seen many houseboats or floating dwellings. Some of these houseboats were very large and evidently housed large families. The writer was informed that many Martians who have charge of the waterways dwell in these habitations. The banks above the canal were covered with green grass and many flowers. On subsequent occasions I was shown other canals and reservoirs, and the manner in which some of the canals were cut through the mountains. In some instances the walls of the canals were almost perpendicular. Steep cuts, even in soft ground, seemed to be characteristic of all the waterways observed by the writer. On another occasion the writer was given a view of the North Polar regions. At that time the deep snows that covered the ground everywhere were melting. The country seemed to be very hilly. As far as the eye could reach I observed low-lying hills covered with a white mantle of snow. Patches of reddish earth here and there indicated that the thaw was general and that the snow had thinned out in spots. Between the hills I observed a large body of water, and was informed that this was an artificial reservoir which had been created by the damming of a large valley. The sky on this occasion was hidden by a mist, a very natural phenomenon in view of the fact that many thousands of square miles of the country, covered with snow on this part of Mars, was undergoing a rapid thaw. That the large dark-colored areas on Mars, supposed by early observers to be seas, and nothing more or less than low, swampy land covered with rank vegetation, was evidenced to me on one occasion when I was permitted to see the true character of these portions of the planet. The rank vegetation was about 3 feet high and of a greenish-red color. Interspersed throughout the mass of coarse-leafed plants were high, dry stalks, the remnants of an earlier crop of Martian flora. The season seemed to be advanced and all plant life was taking on autumnal tints. It was in December 1919 that I saw the first close-up picture of a Martian woman. Her head was covered with a thin veil which came down to her well-formed mouth. She seemed to be a most beautiful woman with most expressive eyes. Her hair was black. Her skin was unusually white, which contrasted with the dark hair. She wore no jewelry, or other ornaments that I could see. On a subsequent occasion I was permitted to see a Martian male. He was playing a flute-like instrument, and as he was quite close to me I could observe the wax-like texture of his skin. This semi-transparency of the skin is characteristic of the Martians, and evidences a life that is free from the many bodily ailments that afflict humanity on our Earth. The Martian was dressed in graceful but loose-fitting clothes of a reddish-brown color. His eyes were a deep blue and his lips seemed to be unusually red. In respect to stature he was, I would say, about 5 feet 9 inches in height. In fact, on subsequent occasions I have observed crowds of Martians gathered together and they appeared no different from the inhabitants of our own world except as to clothing, which is much simpler, but more graceful than our styles. I was informed by the spiritual control that the fauna of Mars is varied, but that all animal life is domesticated, there being now no wild animals on the planet. It was shortly after I had seen the Martians, described in the foregoing paragraph, that I was shown two cat-like animals, which at the time of my vision were engaged in playing about the feet of Martian. They did not exactly resemble cats, but were more feline than canine. They were about the size of a large Airedale, and of a dark, reddish-brown color with deep black stripes, similar to the markings of our tigers. They were very playful and cavorted about just as our own dogs and cats do when endeavoring to attract the attention of their masters. On the morning of January 20, 1920, I was shown another Martian canal. On this occasion I observed a large building on the banks of the waterway near my point of vision. This building was more of a grandstand with a roof than anything else I can compare it to. It consisted of a large framework painted white, and was as high as our two-storied structures. A multitude of the people were inside the building, some sitting, some standing. They all seemed to be intently gazing in a northerly direction, upstream. Much green foliage and varied colored flowers lined the banks of the canal, especially in the neighborhood of the building. The people all seemed to be attired in holiday garb, and it was evident to me that a celebration was going on. Later I was informed that what I had witnessed was an annual celebration observed by the people of Mars on the occasion of arrival of the first water from the North Pole after commencement of the Martian spring. It appears that this occasion is a very important event with the Martians, as the arrival of the life-giving moisture from the Arctic and Antarctic regions of the planet ensures a season of plenty for the inhabitants. The water arrives at the equatorial regions in a little less than a Martian month, 60 days, after the commencement of the polar thaws and after a season of thanksgiving to the Father has been held by all in appreciation of his bountiful gifts. The spiritual leaders of the different communities preside at these gatherings. The foregoing is in remarkable agreement with a statement on page 375 of the late Professor Lowell's book titled Mars, as follows. The canal quickening on Mars occupied 52 days, as evidenced by the successive vegetal darkenings which descend from latitude 72 degrees north and latitude 0, a journey of 2,650 miles. The rate of progression is remarkably uniform, and this fact that it is carried from near the pole to the equator is sufficient telltale of extrinsic aid, and the uniformity of the action increases its significance. On the morning of January 21 I witnessed another interesting Martian scene, which was almost identical with the previous vision of the Arctic regions of this planet, except that the warm season was more advanced, and I was permitted to see the country from another angle. I was facing east. Most of the polar snow had disappeared, and the low-lying hills were now covered with a growth of dark green vegetation, except at a few isolated points which showed small patches of snow. The sky was less misty than on the previous occasion. On the evening of January 21, I was shown a flock of Martian sheep. The herd was small and I observed five of the animals at close range. I call them sheep for the reason that the animals resembled our sheep in every particular. The wool was very long and of a dark reddish-brown color, except underneath their bellies, which was yellowish. On the evening of January 29 I had a vision of a beautiful woman with a child kneeling at her feet. She was seated on a chair and held a book on her lap. The symbolism of the vision was later explained to me by the controls, who said, "Verily I say unto you, whosoever shall not receive the kingdom of God as a little child, he shall not enter therein." God's truths are perceived only by those who can acquire the simple faith of a child. It was about the same time I had a vision in which I saw Stius for the first time distinctly. He is the principal control dominating the writing of this book. He appeared very patriarchal with a long beard. His features were decidedly Semitic. His countenance was most spiritual and beautiful. On February 10 I had my first vision of Mars to moons, known to our astronomers as Deimos and Phobos. The latter appeared as a satellite about half as large as our full moon, and the former like a star brighter than the first magnitude, and could be compared with Jupiter as seen from our Earth during a favorable opposition of that planet. The latter satellite sheds considerable light on her primary. An interesting explanation of these two moons will be found in a later chapter of this book. On February 17 I was shown the actual appearance of our Sun from the planet Mars. What I saw disproves the theory that owing to the distance of Mars from the Sun, the latter would be viewed by the Martians as a disk about half the size as seen from our Earth. The solar orb appeared as to size and brightness, about the same as viewed from our Earth, and seemed to give forth its heat with the same intensity. I was facing the Sun and its brilliance blinded my eyes for an instant. On the evening of February 29 I had a vision of a strange-looking creature ape-like in appearance. The form was about 5 feet tall, very hairy, his body being covered with a thick coat of woolly hair of a grayish color. He was smoking what appeared to be a cigar-like roll of something, probably some sort of leaves rolled up into a convenient form for smoking. On the tips of his pointed ears were little tufts of long hair, which gave his head a lynx-like appearance. There were quite a number of large yellow spots on his hairy chest. His nose was very stubby, and his entire face was decidedly ape-like. I was later informed that I had seen an inhabitant of the planet Mercury, where life has not yet evolved to a very high degree, and where man has not yet wholly emerged from his primary beast-like state. Concerning the flora of Mars, I have on various occasions viewed orchards of growing fruit trees. The trees were set out in rows similar to the methods adopted in our own orchards. The trees were dwarf-like, being not over 5 or 6 feet high. I was informed that this particular species of tree was cultivated for its fruit and for the fiber obtained from its large leaves, which is made into cloth, thread and cordage. On one occasion a short time after the chapter dealing with the transmission of electromagnetic energy by wireless was received, I was shown to immense towers on the planet Mars which I used for the purpose of distributing power throughout the planet. The two towers were very close together, probably 100 yards apart and 100 feet high. They resembled two immense round smokestacks, such as are common in our factory districts. The tops of the towers were surmounted by oval caps, transparent as if made from glass, and protected by a system of grille work. While I was intently observing the towers, there occurred a blinding flash of light simultaneously from the two oval caps. The surrounding country was covered with high trees, and it was impossible for me to observe the base of the two structures. Chapter 8. Knowledge of God comes from within. Mars, with its teeming millions of inhabitants, whose dwellings, factories, storehouses, etc. cover most of the entire area, has no watchmen, policemen or other guardians of the peace to prevent unlawful acts on the part of its people. as all property is considered as belonging to the Father, and is held in common by the people of the planet, there exists no incentive for anyone to steal. Each individual has all he requires for his comfort. Hence, why should anyone covet what is in the possession of his brother? There is no temptation on Mars for anyone to take more than he needs, for selfishness has been entirely eliminated from our planet. Selfishness has no place among really civilized beings. It is a relic of the jungle where it is necessary to perpetuate the lower animal life. You of your Earth have reverted or degenerated to a primordial condition or state through the law of atavism. This is a part of your fall from divine grace. And to induce man on your globe to realize his pitiful condition and redeem himself is the work of the spirits from the higher spheres who are now with you. Mars has no church system and no ecclesiastical hierarchy. All Martians recognize and worship one God, the Eternal Father. Each individual is taught from infancy to seek God through the doors of his own soul, which is an institutional faculty possessed by everyone. Jesus Christ, who came to your earth 2,000 years ago with a message, is known to us. The Christ is one of the greatest powers in the universe next to the Creator. Your sectarian church systems are a hindrance to the proper spiritual development of the individual. These systems engender an element of dependability on the individual which holds back his spiritual enfoldment and perverts his true individuality, which must grow and unfold before real progress upwards begins. All knowledge of God should come from within and not through the instrumentality of imperfect individuals, such as your religious teachers are. The present lack of interest, in 1920, in sectarian matters on the part of the inhabitants of your earth is evidence of a slow but sure disintegration of a system that has held your people in mental and spiritual bondage for centuries, and presages the dawn of a better day for humanity on your earth. Chapter 9. Mars has no political system. When love rules a community of people, there is no need of administrative bureaus for the regulation of the lives of the inhabitants who make up the population of a planet. For the same reason, Mars has no gubernatorial or political administrative center. This announcement may, in a measure, be a disappointment to many readers who have imagined that no considerable number of human beings could live and prosper without the aid and guidance of a complex administrative system such as you have on your Earth. Bureaucracy and autocracy are evils resulting from an undeveloped civilization, and have no place in a community where selfishness has been eliminated. When each individual of a vast population, such as that of Mars, is actuated and guided by the light within, there is no need for a horde of political parasites to direct the destinies of the race. This lack of an administrative system on Mars also applies to its industrial and economic side. The law of supply and demand determines just how many factories there should be, and just what output is necessary for a given period. But it must be remembered that the law of supply and demand on our planet has no relation to a competitive system such as yours, for we have no competitor, a fact that will be impressed elsewhere in this book. It is true that certain of our people who have been specially singled out by the dominating influence of the invisible world are occasionally appealed to by those in doubt as to what is best for their individual welfare, or the welfare of the community at large, to act in advisory capacities. These are the spiritual advisors of the planet, and are really God's prophets. There was a time when your race was guided by similar individuals, as is evidenced from mention of them in your sacred scriptures. But their usefulness was lost when man on your earth forgot God. It was then that man mistrusted the light within, and disregarded the unwritten laws graven in the soul by the Creator. He clamored for a code of laws and received them, through Moses. His next downward step was taken when he admitted it was necessary to have interpreters of the law, for if the spirit of the law had been kept, there would have been no misunderstanding or juggling of the letter. Soon there was so much of this turning and twisting to suit man's growing selfishness, that there was need for someone in authority over all the interpreters, whose word should be final. So your people cried aloud for kings. And you have them, and your law has grown to immense proportions, as have also the clever sins of your selfishness. Where there is no sin, there is no need of laws, for the righteous man is a law unto himself. It must not be imagined that because of the lack of a political system on Mars, such as you deem necessary on your Earth, that all is chaos and life a sort of happy-go-lucky existence. On the contrary, the Martian existence is controlled by the acme of system, which is in accordance with the law of divine harmony. A system from which has been eliminated all the useless wheels which so clog up your lives and make your progress slow indeed. Chapter 10. Mars is ruled by love. And now abideth faith, hope and love, these three, but the greatest of these is love. Paul to the Corinthians. There is but one law on Mars. That law is love. This law is not written in a code for the guidance of the people. It is graven in the hearts of the inhabitants, and is reflected in the countenance of every individual. This law is the incentive before the entire population and urges each individual onward to the completion of the task before him. There are no rulers to bow before, neither is anyone better than his brother. There is no evil, for all are good, all are equal. God endows every individual expression of life with the divine heritage of the pure soul. It is the individual's concern to keep this heavenly gift unstained in its descent into matter. The love force of the Spirit is the potent agent that does this for the individual when allowed to permeate and radiate the entire being. When individuals have learned to bathe their innermost beings in the Father's love, then it must follow that a nation made up of such individuals will be governed only by such precepts as are evolved from this dominating love force. It is of no import to the individual on this planet what his particular task may be, for all work is for the Father, and the humblest vocation, humbler from the point of view of the dwellers on your Earth, is as important and as honorable as the highest. Mars is ruled by love, which is in accordance with the divine intent. It is the desire of the Father that every world in limitless space inhabited by his children be ruled by that divine principle. For when love is the supreme law of a world, as it is of the universe, there is no need of a system of complex laws and a horde of judicial officers to interpret and enforce them. When love enters into the life of a community, selfishness makes its exit, misery becomes a stranger and pain and sickness vanish. From the cradle to transition, the Martian is dominated by love and guided by the Father's will. The result of this love rule is individual and communal happiness, but above all, a spiritual progress that unfolds the individual in accordance with the cosmic intent. To die, in the sense of passing out of one's physical environment, is the destiny of every created being. Hence, in that sense, death exists on Mars as it does on your Earth. But the real death referred to by Christ, a spiritual death imposed on man by his fall from grace, a penalty for having forgotten God, is unknown on this planet Mars. We are in harmony with the Father. Those who are spiritually dead are cut off from the Father as a result of their indifference and ignorance of spiritual truth. The religion of the Martian may be expressed in two thoughts: love and thy will be done, not mine. The true definition of religion is a rule of life, and as our lives are guided entirely by love and the Father's will, we have a religion. You, on your Earth, have created a religion to satisfy your conventionalities. Truth is simple, but you have made it intricate. It is free, yet you buy it from the would-be disciples. Both you and we must approach him in simple faith. Unless ye become as little children, ye cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. Speaking of children, I desire to give expression to a thought that may appear to be outside the subject. It is this: the beauty and simplicity of youth is wonderful, and to be admired by all, but in the sight of the Heavenly Father, and those who have progressed to higher realms, it is not so wonderful as those older characters who have waded the marshes of life, as it were, and who have trod the dirty steps without losing faith. This is to encourage those who sometimes think, when they look back on their lives, that all is dark. Their strength is being tried in the darkness, therefore their courage and faith is so much more. We who are giving you these messages have passed beyond the stage you're in, and do not have to be tried on every hand. We look upon you who are struggling through the pitfalls created by your false systems with pity, knowing how great your trials are. Do not think that because we have gone on to higher planes of life that we are out of sympathy with you. The more we bask in the sunshine of love, the more tender we become to those in the shadow. And if you would only realize how strong you are, with the Father's love and His real consideration for you, you would try so much harder to better your condition by meeting His love with love.